Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Monday, February 18th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a fun conversation on the way for you. Today, I was able to catch up with Jordan Sperber. He is the host of the Solving Basketball Podcast. He is the man behind the Hoop Vision 68 Twitter account. He is one of the brightest young minds in college basketball media. He is very analytically driven. He is an X's and O's savant. And he is one of the smartest people that you can follow on Twitter and listen to and watch on YouTube. He is definitely worth paying attention to, and I was able to catch up with him, and we talked a lot about this Tennessee-Kentucky game, the way that the Big 12 is playing out, injuries to Nick Ward and Dean Wade, and I made Jordan have three hot takes, which is not something that he usually does. So those are going to be interesting, especially if you are a Gonzaga, a Duke, or a Kansas fan. Before I get into that conversation, I got to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast in any app that you listen to podcasts in. If you have an interaction with this episode, whether it's rating or reviewing or downloading or subscribing, it really does help us. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. It helps make my bosses happy. And when my bosses are happy, I'm happy. When I'm happy, you are getting a better episode every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. So if you like what you hear here, give me five stars, say something nice about me, make my day just that much better. Now let's get into that conversation with Jordan Sperber. And now I am thrilled to welcome onto the podcast what happens when analytics nerds meet X's and O's experts. He is a former video coordinator for Division I programs. He currently runs the Solving Basketball podcast, which you can find on iTunes and anywhere where podcasts are freely found. And he also runs the Hoop Vision Twitter account and the Hoop Vision YouTube channel. It is Jordan Sperber. Jordan, what's going on, man? How you doing?
Hey, Rob. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I just got to give your podcast another little bump because I think that the content that you put out is as unique and as smart as any that you can find on college basketball Twitter and on, online for people that cover the sport. So if you do enjoy getting a little deeper into just diving into narratives and following, Kentucky's back. Oh, Tennessee stinks because they lost. If you want some real good content and really good analysis, you guys need to go find Jordan's work. It is terrific. And I do want to talk to you a little bit about that to start. Just, take me through what your history is, what your coaching background is, and why you decided that you wanted to get into this media, the media game and the media business.
Yeah, so I actually started Hoop Vision is what the name I came up with when I was a junior in high school. And so I was playing varsity basketball at the time, but also a stats nerd and an X's and O's nerd. I wasn't very good at it yet, but I started a blog and a Twitter account, and eventually in college, that Twitter account specifically led to me networking with some coaches. And the first two that reached out to me, Eric Musselman, who was an assistant at Arizona State at the time, and Paul Weir, who was an assistant at New Mexico State at the time, those ended up being my first two jobs out of college. I was a graduate assistant at Nevada for Coach Muss for a year, and then video coordinator at New Mexico State for two. I worked for both Paul Weir and Chris Jans there. And yeah, getting back into the media and also some consulting stuff that I do had always been on my mind. Almost did it when Paul Weir left for New Mexico and I wasn't sure if I was going to be retained or not. I almost did it a year early, but I learned a ton from Coach Jans. He's one of the best game planners, I think, among head coaches in the country. And so it has really made my content better, I think, by working for him and all three of those coaches.
I think one of my favorite things that you do is the way that you kind of break down how a team matches up with somebody else and what they are going to do. I'll give you an example. Your Tennessee-Kentucky scouting thread had a really good breakdown about how Tennessee creates space in the lane with big men that just kind of wall off and hold position and duck in, and the way that Kentucky can counter that, and then what Tennessee can do to counter Kentucky's counters. And it's very much
what you would expect to see kind of out of a college film session and a college scouting report. And I think it's something unique that people are going to be able to see that they maybe wouldn't otherwise have access to. So let me ask you this. When it comes to the way that coaches kind of scout and coaches kind of game plan, what do you think is maybe the biggest misconception that people have about it? How much time do they spend putting these things together? And, you know, how much, if you are showing this kind of film to 18 to 21-year-olds that have the attention span of, you know, the amount of time it takes for Instagram to refresh, how do you kind of translate that to something that they can kind of manage and something they can ingest and understand?
Yeah, so that's a great question, especially about the attention span of the guys. The three staffs I worked on, I can tell you this, we watched a lot of film, a lot. So on the front end, there was a lot of time going into it, but then with the players in a group setting, and occasionally in small groups or one-on-one too, but for the most part, it was in group settings. These guys were watching really by the end of a scouting for a team, as long as you had a regular amount of time for prep, like an hour or two of film probably on a team. And I had a pretty good seat at New Mexico State. The way it's set up is I was in charge of the computer, which is in front. The only people on our staff that could see everyone watching the film, like their eyes would be whoever is presenting. So Coach Jans or an assistant coach, and then myself. And I would definitely look at engagement, how engaged guys are. And I would be lying if eyes don't get a little droopy sometimes in film sessions. I think it's on the staff to figure out the best way to be as comprehensive as possible, but also as engaging and have as much buy-in as possible. It's a balance.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, I can sit here and I can watch the breakdowns that you put together. I can watch, you know, hours and hours of one team playing to try to figure out how they're going to run an offense or what they're going to do defensively. And it's something that I really enjoy, but I also realize that I am probably in the overwhelming minority when it comes to that. The last thing before we actually talk about basketball, I need your best Eric Musselman story, because everybody that I know that has worked for him has a great Eric Musselman story. So you got to give me your best one.
Well, Jeff Goodman was on my podcast and was asking me about the same thing. So I'm going to reuse here. But on Goodman's podcast with Jay Wright, they were talking about Javon Quinterly and how the Villanova fan base has been at some points in the season, mostly just dependent on if they're playing well or not, critical of Javon Quinterly not playing more. And Jeff's point was that no college basketball coach is. He doesn't have it out for Javon Quinterly. He's just trying to win games. There's no like ulterior motive here. There's a lot at stake. Like these coaches want to win games. And so I agreed with Jeff, but the unique thing about college basketball compared to the NBA, and Mus being an NBA guy would bring stuff like this up all the time, how you just don't have to deal with this kind of stuff in the NBA. APR, which is Academic Progress Report, it determines your postseason eligibility and some flexibility in your program. It's something that's not basketball related, but it's supposed to incentivize graduation rates and grades in your program. And when you're a new coach and you're inheriting new players, you're potentially susceptible to transfers because you didn't recruit those kids and they have to buy in. And so if you have a lot of turnover, if a lot of guys transfer, it can hurt your APR. And so after a game one time, Mus said to our staff that during the game, as he's trying to win the game, in the back of his mind, he's thinking about APR and, you know, if I don't play this kid, how is this going to affect us? And that speaks to kind of how crazy the NCAA is with their incentive system, but also to Coach Mus, who is like the CEO of a program. I mean, he has his hands in everything. Whether it's recruiting, they do tons of stuff on social media. And so, it's one example of just a lot going on in the college basketball world.
What's your take on this Nevada team? Can they win a national title?
So it's tough. Like Gonzaga is another team right now who isn't playing the quality of competition that these high majors are playing right now. But clearly both Gonzaga and Nevada have a ton of talent. The thing that I would be worried about with Nevada is they're not, at least analytically, they're not winning by people get on the WCC and Gonzaga almost they penalize Gonzaga for these blowouts as if that's indicative of the WCC. Well, the fact of the matter is the WCC is a little bit better this year than normal, and Gonzaga's just really, really good blowing teams out. And we haven't seen that quite as much from Nevada. They clearly have the talent to make a Final Four. I mean, they were pretty close last year, and those guys are back, plus Trey Porter and Jordan Brown and these other guys. But just from a straight-up analytical perspective, a Final Four team would likely be beating these Mountain West opponents by a little bit more.
Yeah, that's fair enough. My big thing with them, and I mentioned this on the podcast I did with Brian Snow last week, is just I feel like the way that Eric Musselman runs his offense is more or less saying, okay, look, we have Caleb Martin, we have Cody Martin, and we have Jordan Caroline. Those guys are going to win whatever matchup they're in, so we're just going to find how to get them in a position to score, and we're going to let them go and do their thing. And I'm just not convinced, as good as those guys are, I'm not convinced that they are good enough to do that against some of the best teams in the country. So while I think that they'll probably win a couple of games in March, and I would not be surprised to see them get back to the second weekend, even get to an Elite Eight, I just think that there's a little bit of a ceiling when you are relying on guys that aren't surefire NBA players to go out and just win a matchup.
Yeah, I guess the counter there would be that they're not surefire NBA players, but they are like 23 years old or whatever. So they, I mean, I saw someone on Twitter put together a little highlight reel of announcers from different games talking about the fifth year seniors and how old Nevada is. It's like it's their narrative. But
and it's not just a narrative, man. I think every single player in their, like, other than Jordan Brown, every player in their top nine can go out and drink legally and have been able to drink legally for like 2 years now.
Yeah, no, it's a fact, right? Versus a narrative, it's a fact. But the one thing that kind of style of play has done really well for Nevada is they just don't turn the ball over with all that freedom. So they were number one in the country in turnover percentage last year. They're number three this year. I agree with you. Sometimes that teams can really load up on them. And we've seen, especially in the first half of games, they seem to struggle a little bit. And to me, that might have something to do with you're hyper-focused on the game plan. This is a little bit who knows if this is really true, but you're hyper-focused on your game plan. You can really key in on the Martins. You shrink the floor. So maybe that has been playing into some of the slow starts. But those turnovers, the fact that they don't turn it over, does make it a good offense.
Yeah, and eventually you got to figure, like, at some point in the game, Caleb Martin's going to get hot and, you know, run off 10 to 12 points in like a 3-minute span. And you know Jordan Caroline at some point is going to find a way to kind of get it going a little bit. So I think that Nevada is one of those teams where I would not be surprised to see them get picked off in like the first weekend. And would not be surprised to see them, you know, be the team that ends up beating the one seed and the two seed in their region to get to the Final Four. It's one of those things. All right. So like I mentioned before, you had a really good scouting thread on the Tennessee-Kentucky game heading into it. I'm sure that you've watched that game by now, and I'm just kind of curious, how do you think it played out? Are you of the mindset that Tennessee is now the worst team in America, like I think some people are saying? Is Kentucky better than the Cleveland Cavaliers at this point? What are your what did you take away from that game?
So it was, I think it went about as would be expected pregame schematically or game plan wise. So The game was really, really physical, and there were only four free throw attempts in the first half, which completely changed in the second half. I think it was equally physical in both halves. For whatever reason, the refs let a lot of things go, and I don't think that necessarily favored one team or another. They were both, like you said, to start out. Reed Travis and Grant Williams both are just kind of undersized. Grant Williams a little bit more than Reed Travis, but physical, strong post players. And so that was the story of the first half for me. Tennessee runs this motion offense where they post up a lot, and Kentucky was basically hitting them before they could even make their motion cuts. And the post-ups weren't as effective because a team like Kentucky that has the length to Tennessee never has very good spacing in a game, but sometimes teams don't have the combination of length and physicality. And despite bad spacing, which was kind of what that pregame thread was about, they're the number two offense in the country right now. So it looked at times almost like a little bit of a football game. Even Kentucky runs Tyler Hero and not just him. They run Keldon Johnson off a lot of screens. And on the other end, Tennessee was really being physical with them. The difference in the first half especially and in the game was after all that physical play, they were throwing the ball into P.J. Washington, who had a really good game.
Yeah, P.J. was great. And everything going over the left shoulder, it seemed like he made the same move like five or six different times in the first half, and Tennessee just didn't have an answer. I was really impressed with Reed Travis, especially in the second half, because I think he was a little bit better defensively, but he just basically took away Grant Williams. And a lot of what Tennessee does is basically run their offense through Grant, because he's smart, he's a pretty good passer, and he is a guy that he kind of thrives on the fact that he's going to be stronger than whoever he's going up against. And, you know, like you said, he's a little bit shorter, so he has a lower center of gravity, and you know, he gets leverage that way, and he understands angles, and he understands how to seal people off, and he's very much a land warrior in that sense. And I don't know if there's a worse possible matchup for him in the way that he plays than Reed Travis. And, you know, we don't normally talk about how good Reed Travis is defensively. I think, like, the narrative of Kentucky's season is that they need to find a way to like get Nick Richards to be better than what Reed Travis is. But I thought that the way that he was able to take away Grant Williams is something that not a lot of teams are going to be able to do. And he also I think he drew two of the fouls in the second half against Kyle Alexander and got him out of the game, which put Tennessee in a situation like they don't have front court depth. It's basically like Grant Williams and Kyle Alexander. And if one of those guys gets a blow, then they move Admiral Schofield up to the four. And that put Tennessee in a situation for like a 10-minute stretch in the second half where they had to find a way to guard Reed Travis and Nick Richards and P.J. Washington and Kentucky's big athletic front line with two guys that are like 6'5 on a good day. And I think that that also played a role. So I was really impressed with Reed Travis.
Yeah, that's a great point about – so to me, Admiral Schofield – is a four playing the three. Like they play Schofield, Williams, and Kyle Alexander, and I think it hurts them offensively, which is ridiculous because, like I said, they're the number two offense in the country. They're probably the best offense in the SEC. It helps them defensively, though, especially against a team like Kentucky, and I'd probably been focusing more on the other side of the ball, and I think you're right. It put them in a tough position having Schofield guard bigs. But to go to the side of the ball, I was focusing on when Schofield's at the three. He's a good shooter, but he's a little bit hesitant. And this was something that you talked about on Twitter is Grant Williams is in that trail spot, and Kentucky basically doesn't have to guard him. So whoever whether it's Alexander or Grant Williams, one of them will be the lead post and duck in and try to get an easy basket, and the other one will be out on the three-point line trailing. And what teams do against Tennessee is they don't guard the trail guy and help out inside. And so I thought that maybe that foul trouble with Alexander helps their offense, But this is sort of a larger conversation in college basketball. If you look at the top teams this year, most of them are playing at least two bigs. And really, I think that last year with the NCAA tournament, UMBC and Marshall and Loyola, there was this narrative that the NBA trickle down effect, spacing and guard play and having stretch fours or a guard at the four was going to win out. And I really don't think that that has bore itself out in this season. And Tennessee and Kentucky are both really good examples of that.
Yeah, I would make the argument that we're not seeing like four guards, but it's much more, you know, when you're playing two bigs, the second big is much more perimeter oriented than we see it in the past, right? Like when Duke has their two bigs out there, their second big is basically Zion Williamson. When I know Virginia starts Diakite, but it seems like their best lineups come when they have Braxton Key and DeAndre Hunter playing together, and they can get more into like their away from their block remover offense and more into you know, kind of like a ball screen kind of deal. You know, Gonzaga, I would not call either Brandon Clark or Rui Hachimura traditional big men. You know, even PJ Washington, like I think the reason that he's kind of come around and is being so effective right now is that he's really improved on what he could do away from the basket. So I think that we're not quite – like nobody's going to be what Villanova was last year. Like that is – they were – I think you can make the argument they were one of the best teams that we've seen in like the last decade in college basketball, if not the best team. So no one's going to be what they were. But I do think that we're starting to see the way that teams utilize that four spot changing a little bit. Although, you know, it feels like forever. You go all the way back to like VCU in 2011. When they made the Final Four, it's because they played Jamie Skeen at the four. And they were basically doing what these teams are doing now. So I don't necessarily think it's new in terms of what college basketball teams can do, especially like the mid-majors that we're trying to match up with some of these bigger teams.
So I think you're right about they're more skilled. And I remember you saying that on my podcast, actually, about it's not about small ball, it's skill ball. And so I think you're right there. I guess the distinction I would make is how coaches are utilizing their fours and fives.
Yep.
They're basically interchangeable still. So the best example of this is North Carolina, where Nasir Little obviously has played some three, played some four. In North Carolina's system, in their secondary break and their motion offense, the four and the five are interchangeable. It's hard to have a stretch four or a wing four play that system without changing something. And even Gonzaga, who neither of those guys are centers. Well, the four and the five in Gonzaga's system are pretty much interchangeable. In Virginia's system, in the blocker mover, again, the four and the five do the same exact thing. And even in their continuity ball screen, the way they do it, the four and the five do the same exact thing. Really, the one team who is well, Duke, and Duke is kind of on its own with Zion at the four. I mean that. If you go back 1 year with Bagley and Carter, obviously they were totally different. But Michigan and John Beilein is the one where Iggy Brazdeikis is not doing anything similar to what John Teske is doing at the four and five. They are sort of the modern offense, spread ball screens, and the four and the five are very distinct.
Yeah, and it feels like Beilein's been doing that since Kevin Pitsnoggle was a thing.
Yep.
Last thing, and then we can move on from this. Tennessee, do you still consider them like a top five kind of team, a national title contender? And are you fully on board with this idea that Kentucky's back?
So Tennessee is, yes, they're a national title contender. I think that a top three of Duke, Virginia, and Gonzaga has emerged pretty good here. It is now being shown by something like KenPom or the analytics rankings. But even before that, Duke and Virginia have been sort of a step above the whole season. Just more from an eye test or an X's and O's perspective, it sure seemed to me like Gonzaga was right there. again, if you're a WCC skeptic or a mid-major skeptic, it's going to be hard to convince you, and that's fair. But they're just, to me, those three teams are, they don't have much downside, and there's not too many flaws there. And then Tennessee and Kentucky, to me, are in that next tier. And that's not to say that one of those three that I mentioned, Virginia, Duke, or Gonzaga, will all make the Final Four or anything like that. Odds are one of them will not make the Final Four. Maybe even the odds would be that two won't. But yeah, I would say that that in general, we're probably overreacting a little bit to both Tennessee and Kentucky. They're both really good teams. And when they play each other again soon here, I'm sure we'll overreact the other way when the game's at Tennessee this time.
Yeah, it's almost like people forget that, playing at home actually matters in college basketball.
A lot. It matters a lot.
Yeah. But the only thing about tennis, like I've been on this Kentucky's back bandwagon since probably the win over North Carolina. The only concern that I would have with Tennessee is I think this kind of showcased what you can do to beat them. You know, I like their guards. I think their guards are good. I don't think that their guards are necessarily great. And I worry about what happens when you are able to take away Grant Williams and not let them what they want to do offensively. Who do they have that can kind of go out and take the game over? I think that Jordan Bowden really struggled against Kentucky. I think that Lamont Turner really struggled against Kentucky. Admiral Schofield was like, I think he had 19, but he was 7 for 18 from the floor. And Jordan Bowen finished with 19 and 6, but 11 of those points and 4 of those assists came after Tennessee was down by 24 points in the second half. So a little bit of garbage time. I don't want to call it stat padding, but a little bit of scoring and production there when the game was more or less already decided. Real quick before we get into some of your hot takes where you're going to kind of argue, talk me into things that maybe I don't necessarily agree with. What are you more concerned with, Nick Ward's injury to Michigan State or Dean Wade's injury with Kansas State? For people that don't know, Nick Ward suffered a left hand injury. They are calling it a hairline fracture. And I'm not sure he's going to be done for the season. It did not sound like in the statement that Michigan State put out that this is the kind of thing where, he has to undergo surgery and he's done for the year. They said they're going to evaluate him week by week. He tried to play in the second half yesterday and that went over Ohio State. And it was very clear that he was in too much pain to be able to, he couldn't even clap his hands, let alone catch a ball with his left hand. Nick Ward is left-handed. And then Dean Wade suffered, it looked like I'm not sure exactly what he did. He hurt his right foot again, which is the foot that kept him out for 6 games earlier this season in the loss at home against Iowa State on Saturday. And it doesn't sound like Bruce Weber, again, is too worried about it. He didn't say he's done for the year. He said this is kind of like a pain tolerance thing. And Kansas State does have 2 games against West Virginia and Oklahoma State coming up. But it's very clear that without him, they are a different team on the offensive end of the floor. So who are you more worried about?
Yeah, I think this is the hardest thing to currently evaluate in college basketball right now is a player goes down. How impactful is that player? What will they look like without that player? It's really, really hard to do. And I would give the nod to Nick Ward and Michigan State simply because it's now their second player that's out. So given that Joshua Langford is done for the year, at a certain point, I would imagine that these injuries and losing talent starts to have maybe even like double or triple the effect. And so, like you said, we don't really know how long Ward is out for. But just in the immediate short term, you know, Nick Ward does some things at a really, really high level. He does some things not so well. You know, you probably want to put him in ball screens. He's not the most mobile guy. I think he plays pretty hard. He's really good at rim running and using his body. He's a big body, obviously. On its own, I think that Michigan State can survive it. Maybe they can't necessarily replace the exact strengths that Nick Ward does, but they can bring in players that do things differently, not necessarily worse, but just differently. But to me, it's the combination of Langford and Ward now that probably makes his loss a little bit more impactful than Dean Wade and Kansas State.
Yeah, and I think it's probably worth mentioning that Kansas State has played without Dean Wade before, so they they weren't very good without him. They were actually pretty bad when he wasn't there. He's their best shooter. He's their best passer. He is the guy that can kind of let them break down a zone, which is something they weren't able to do when he was not on the floor. But with Nick Ward, like, it's just, I think I agree with you, because he just turns into the pressure release. I think that Big Ten coaches have figured out that you can kind of, one, Cassius Winston is a little bit turnover prone. Like, he will make some mistakes upon occasion, and you can wear him down a little bit, especially when he's playing like 39 minutes a game as their sole source of offense when he is being guarded 94 feet. So what Nick Ward does, because like you could say a lot of things about him, but he is great running in transition. They get like two or three buckets a game just off of Nick Ward beating his man down the floor and Cassius Winston finding him. And he becomes that pressure release where, you know, when you give him the ball on the block, he can go out and get a bucket and you can let Cassius Winston kind of catch a breather. You throw him the ball on the block and he gets fouled, and all of a sudden Cassius Winston has a minute to kind of relax and catch his breath and get his legs back a little bit. So I think that having that presence really does just kind of help Cassius Winston stay on the floor and stay rested and stay with energy. And if Cassius Winston isn't playing at his best, you know, like we saw in that loss at Illinois, I think that Michigan State is a very, very, very different basketball team.
Yeah, no doubt. And then on the flip side, going back to Dean Wade, I guess if you wanted to make Kansas State fans feel okay about it, I mean, they haven't been that good offensively this year with or without him. They're a defensive first team. They did it in the NCAA tournament last year on defense without him. And so that would be, I guess, my logic behind them being able to survive that is defense is their identity. It's really the identity of the Big 12 in general. Those games are ugly, and they can probably still win ugly without Dean Wade.
All right, so this is actually a perfect segue to get into Kansas and the Big 12 race a little bit. For people that don't necessarily follow your content, Jordan is not the most hot takey kind of a guy. Like everything that he does is very well researched. It's detail oriented. You know, he's not putting out content that's just based off of like a one game reaction. It's very well thought out. So I asked him to come up with three hot takes that he can have on this podcast where he can try to talk me into something that maybe I don't necessarily believe. And one of them involves Dedrick Lawson and Kansas. And so let's start with that. Talk to me about Dedrick Lawson and talk to me about why Kansas is going to end up winning the Big 12 again after we all wrote them off for what, like the 19th straight year.
Well, first of all, to go back to the not being hot takey part, when I first started making videos, I did put so much. These are YouTube videos. I was doing Duke and Kentucky summer breakdowns. This was really the beginning, and I did so much research, and like I was terrified of saying anything that wasn't correct in these like 15-minute videos where you know you're gonna say something that's not correct. So that's just my psyche in the whole thing. Like I just can't really put my opinion out there until I've watched and watched and watched. And so it's probably to a fault at a certain point. But for you, Rob, I'm going to do it.
I'm, I'm fired up for it, man. Let's go.
All right. So I actually talked to Jesse Newell, who's a Kansas beat writer, about this. I was afraid to tweet anything or put anything out, but a few weeks ago, where to me, Dedrick Lawson is so when he has the ball in his hands, he is super skilled for his size, for his weight even. He's light on his feet. He's a good passer. He's a good finisher. But when he does not have the ball in his hands, to me, there's no bigger discrepancy between a player. So he doesn't play that hard, and that's something that coaches are obsessed with is your motor, and it's just not Dedrick Lawson's identity. You know, he's not a very good screen setter. His defense has always been something that people question. he rebounds at a high level, but it's not like he's this box out guy. And so in terms of the biggest discrepancy between someone who has the ball in their hands and doesn't, and the fact of the matter is there's 10 players on the court. You don't have the ball in your hands a lot more than you do. So that's the type of thing that would drive a coach crazy. I have no way of knowing this, but to me, the Kansas coaching staff and Bill Self, considering how good Dedrick Lawson is, I'm sure that he gives them a lot of headaches. And I know that LeGerald Vick has kind of been the guy who's been in the doghouse, and even though he was pretty productive this year when playing. But yeah, I guess I'm not sold on Dedrick Lawson as an All-American candidate, even though, like, the one specific example that I can give you is he kind of waddles. That's the word I have for him. He waddles.
He has a really weird running form.
It's really weird. And I'm not going to name him, but one of the teams I coach, we had a guy pretty similar. And I think that I see some things in Dedrick Lawson that almost give me some PTSD of coaches yelling at this talented player. and so he waddles down the court into the trail spot, and like it looks like he's uninterested. And then as soon as he touches the ball, like, oh my God, then it's on. And he's one dribble, hard left, spin, and finish. It's like, how is that the same player with and without the ball? So there's my Dedrick Lawson take.
Now, do you think that this is the kind of thing that could, like, what does that impact Kansas offensively? Like, how does that change them? And how does what he does off the ball impact what other guys are going to be able to do? Like, I think you mentioned he's not a very good screener. He's not necessarily, he's been making threes recently, but I wouldn't necessarily call him a floor spacer. Like, how does that impact the group as a whole?
Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, Bill, that's it contrasts the typical Bill Self big, which is all about space, clearing out space, sealing for easy baskets. They run all of these plays. And I was talking to Jesse a little bit about this, he's really good at the X's and O's stuff, especially for a beat writer. And Dedrick doesn't necessarily get these easy baskets that we're used to seeing from a Kansas team. He's very content with catching in the mid or the deep post, which isn't what a normal Bill Self big does. And having watched a little bit recently, it seems like they finally aren't trying to force him into that. And maybe that's why they were struggling so much, especially when Azubuike went out, right when Azubuike went out, and while they're playing a little bit better now, is they're playing more to Lawson's strength. I think a huge thing for him will be the shooting. His percentage is up now, but like you said, he wasn't a good shooter at Memphis. He didn't start out the season too well, but if he's going to be more of he's really playing more like a guard at times now. Shooting will be very important for that. And if he continues to, I think Kansas's offense is fine. But it's been inconsistent this year because of that kind of contrast, I think.
Now, I got to get you on the record. Who is winning the Big 12 this year? I need your prediction.
So I'm still taking Kansas, mostly because there's no one else to really hang your hat on, I guess. I thought that Texas Tech had a really good shot. I think I was talking about it with Sam Vecenie on my podcast where – this was already a couple of weeks ago now during their rough stretch, and he was leaning towards taking the field, and I stuck with Kansas, so that I don't think there's any reason now that they've won three in a row to deviate from that. But I don't know if they share it still counts, right? I think they have shared it during the streak. So.
Yeah, they have like five times, I think, something like that.
Yeah,
it's been a bunch.
Exactly. So that seems like a pretty likely scenario right now, relatively speaking, pretty likely. But I think Texas Tech really had their chance, and that's not to say that they can't do it. They're playing pretty good after that losing streak they had, but I'll still stick with Kansas.
Yeah, I think Texas Tech is the one team that could have a chance to actually win it outright, and the reason I say that is twofold. One, they get Kansas at home. which if they win that, they go a game up on Kansas, right? They get Iowa State on the road, which is not going to be easy to do. But if they win that game, then they get a game up on Iowa State. The way the standings currently are is Kansas State has three losses. Then Kansas, Iowa State, and Texas Tech all have four losses, just for people that may not know. So then you get a game up on both of those teams. Kansas State is playing without Dean Wade, and they still have to go to Kansas for a game. So assuming Kansas State loses that and loses one more game somewhere along the line, maybe without Dean Wade, all of a sudden Texas Tech could have a game up on them. And the other three games that they play are Oklahoma State at home, at TCU, and then Texas at home. And those are three very winnable games. So that's what they have going for them for the rest of the season. Now, the thing that really interests me about them is that they're finally shooting the ball. The last three games, they are 34 for 76 from beyond the arc. That is a cool 44.7%. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that they're going to do that for the rest of the year. But if they finally have the confidence to be like a, I don't know, like a 39 or 40% three-point shooting team, if Davide Moretti and Matt Mooney and Jarrett Culver and Kyler Edwards and these guys are going to be anywhere near what they've been over the course of the last 2 weeks, then all of a sudden we have a team that plays a little bit smaller, that is really shooting the ball well, and that just so happens to be the nation's best defense. And I think that you put all of that together, and it is it's intriguing. Let's just leave it at that. And I think that they probably have the best shot of anybody to win this thing outright. That said, it's going to end up being like three teams finish 13-5 is what it's probably going to end up being.
Yeah, right now I'm looking at Kempom right now, and he's got four teams projected at 12-6 in his ratings. So, yeah, it'll be close. And as John Gassaway has been noting, the streak sort of has a way of giving us hope or something. You know, like it just seems conscious or aware of the fact that Kansas always wins and trying to put us in spots where it seems like they might not. But we'll see.
It's unbelievable, man. They lost Udoka Azubuki. They've played the last two games without LeGerald Vick. They've played the last, 3 weeks without Marcus Garrett, and they've never had Silvio D'Souza. They're starting.
They pull the kid off a redshirt.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing.
They're starting four freshmen, one of whom was the seventh man on Mo Cannelly his junior year in high school and was going to redshirt this season, and they are probably going to end up winning the Big 12 again. It's just it's every year, man. It's unbelievable. I don't know how he does it, but, you know, tip of the cap to Bill Self. Let's move on. You mentioned Gonzaga. I know you're really high on them. You said on Twitter that you think Josh Perkins is, I don't know, I don't remember if it was their best player or their most important player, but I want you to tell me why Josh Perkins is the most important guy on that team and why I need to stop hating on Josh Perkins.
So, yeah, I have been really high on Josh Perkins all year. We're going to talk about the next take is going to be Trey Jones and Duke related. And I have watched that game recently, and I wasn't necessarily focusing on the Josh Perkins and Trey Jones matchup. I was more focusing on Gonzaga's offense. It was for a video about their offense. But afterwards I was like, I didn't notice Trey Jones's ball pressure or defense at all that game. And so then I kind of went back again and tried to just look a little bit at that. And, that's my biggest thing for not really buying the turnover prone, part about Josh Perkins. I think it's not that he's shaky with the ball, by any means. He does try to make the home run pass a little bit. He's a really good no look passer. And maybe that's where the turnovers are. He had a high turnover game against North Carolina. I watched all six or seven of them on Synergy, and it was nothing that is habitual or something that it really needs to be corrected. But he plays a much bigger role in their offense than his usage rate indicates, and that's because usage rate there's good reasons why it doesn't incorporate assists, but it doesn't. And Hachimura gets a lot of the credit for offense, and he's a really, really talented big man. Regardless of his NBA or anything like that, he's really hard to guard, and he can pick and pop, he can roll, he can post, he's versatile. And then Brandon Clark is this NBA prospect that NBA guys are obsessed with, and he is a really good shot blocker and he's mobile. But if he's your only chance, in my opinion, at guarding Gonzaga. You can do some things off of Brandon Clark because he's not really a shooter. He'll hurt you if you ignore him too much on the offensive glass. So in my opinion, Brandon Clark has some flaws offensively, at least at the college level, not projecting him out to the NBA. And then Rui Hachimura has some flaws defensively. And then Perkins he kind of just holds it all together. So if they try to run, they play really fast. That's where Clark does a lot of his damage. But if they don't, it's probably coming to Josh Perkins for a ball screen. And he could hold the ball and dribble 20 times a possession, and it would be efficient offense, in my opinion. Probing, trying to make the perfect pass. But then every once in a while, he comes right off of a ball screen, and he just hits Rui right away. I called it restraint. He's got really good restraint to keep them efficient, and they are being almost historically efficient right now as an offense, and I'm giving Josh Perkins a lot of that credit.
So I agree with a lot of it because he is very good in ball screens, and I do think that he has a knack for being able to – he makes passes that you may not necessarily see are there, right? He's got a little bit of that flash to him, and I think that's something he's had all the way back since high school. There are times where it feels like he does things where he may not necessarily have the confidence, I think is probably the way that I want to phrase it. And I don't know if that's changed. I'm going to be honest. I haven't watched a ton of Gonzaga since the WCC started. I'll have it on in the background late at night, but I have a 3-year-old. I have to make dinner at night. There's only so many hours in the day. He's up at 6:30 in the morning, so I'm not going to be up until 1 a.m. every time that Gonzaga plays. And especially when they're winning games by 45 points. There's only so much you can take out of a game that is a blowout. And I do think that Gonzaga is very good and the WCC is better than it is, but there's only so much you can watch or learn about a team when they are doing whatever they want against an overmatched opponent. So I haven't watched a ton of them since the season ended. I feel like he is the guy. Maybe it's because I just can't change an opinion, and first opinions are always going to end up staying with me on this kind of situation. But I just feel like he's still the guy that can make the mistakes, still the guy that can get eaten up by someone providing ball pressure. And I guess if you're saying that's not the case anymore, then maybe I need to go back and look at it again. But it's I don't know. It's something I just can't get out of my head.
Yeah. So I'm the complete opposite here in that, I was during Josh Perkins' career, I was on college basketball staffs and watching mostly the teams that we were going to play, WAC and Mountain West teams. So I really had no experience with Josh Perkins beyond just casually watching a NCAA tournament game or something throughout his career. And so I have none of that, what he struggled with in the 3 years before this one. I agree with you. The point I agree with you about is his aggression sometimes. I think there's two types of aggression, though. When he comes off of a ball screen, he is putting the defense in a tough situation. He's never passive. I shouldn't say never, but he is not going to usually be passive coming off a ball screen. That's different from looking to score, and I think that he probably should look to score a little bit more. I think he did in the second half against Duke. There was one play where he got to the elbow and just kind of stopped on a dime and dropped Trey Jones off. But he doesn't always do that. But it's a little bit subtle in terms of coming off a ball screen, trying to put the defense in a bad position versus trying to get your own shot. And I personally like the point guards and gravitate towards the point guards who are really, really good at reading the floor, and all four guys on all four of his offensive teammates. And like you said, the flare passes, he's really good at whoever's tagging on the ball screen. He's going to look off the tagger and either hit Kispert for a three or hit Clark for the roll, So.
Yeah. And I will say this about him. he's always had these highs, right? For me, it's he's been one of these guys that can be kind of like a high ceiling guy, low floor guy, if that makes some sense, from like a, on a possession to possession basis. And if he's kind of evened it out a little bit, which like you would hope a fifth year senior that's what, like 23 years old is going to do at some point, then that is, that's the kind of thing. I think I made this point before the season. I forget. I think it was with Matt Norlander on the podcast. And he basically said he thought Josh Perkins had a chance to be like a second or third team All-American. And I said, if Josh Perkins is a second or third team All-American, then Gonzaga is probably going to end up winning the national title. And that looks kind of prescient at this point. But let's talk about Trey Jones. I know you have a take about Trey Jones. And this one, I actually think, I don't even think I need you to convince me. I think that I've already gotten there myself. So talk to me about Trey Jones.
Okay, so my take with Trey Jones is much more straightforward, I guess, than the other two, and it's that he's the most overrated player in the country. And before anyone gasps, I mean, a big part about being overrated is the fact that he is very, very highly rated, not that he's not good. Duke is probably the best team in the country, and he's one of the best players on one of the best teams in the country. But the idea that when he went out, that he's the most important player on Duke, if we're unpacking that, Zion Williamson is the best player in the country, but Trey Jones is more important than Duke. So if that's the expectation that we're setting for Trey Jones, that's where I'm saying he's the most overrated player in the country. And it goes, if we're going more into a basketball perspective now, he is very, very good on the ball. He's got great hands. Considering how aggressive he plays, he doesn't get beat that much. He does get beat sometimes. That Louisville game, I thought he was, when they were down by 20, I thought that he was just okay pressuring the Louisville guards, gambling a lot. But that's how Duke plays. Duke gambles a lot, and he's in kind of the perfect system to rev their defense and get into opposing point guards, and he's had some games where he has taken point guards out of the game. And then on the flip side, offensively is where I really think, so he's a good defender, but offensively, you know, Louisville was not guarding him really at all during that game where they played him. They were helping off of him. Usually Trey Jones ends up in the corner. He brings the ball up, but they run a lot of dribble handoff action. And so he winds up in a corner, and Louisville was putting McMahon on him, I believe, for a lot of the game. And whenever they needed early help to Zion or RJ, that was the guy who was there. And then not only was he helping off of him, but once Trey Jones had the ball, it was a short closeout, kind of daring him to shoot. I believe he's still under 30%, not by a lot, but right around there.
He's at 27 right now.
Exactly. And if Duke had a point guard, he sometimes functions as a point guard, and he sometimes doesn't, to be honest. He is the point guard in name. But if Duke had a guard who could shoot 40%, stick him in the corner. Trey Jones does have some creation ability. He does. I've seen him split ball screens and make a floater. But Duke doesn't need that. They have the two best players in the country at that. So that's where I don't know. I don't know if he helps him or hurts him that much either way on offense. And he's good on defense, but it might be a little bit overstated.
Yeah, I don't know if I would agree that it's overstated defensively, but I do think that he is put in a situation where he can get beat. And it's also, he suffers from the same kind of, what's the best way? Inconsistency with Duke. Like, Duke is very much a confidence team on that end of the floor, whereas when things are going well, all of a sudden they're flying around more, and they're getting out in passing lanes more. And that pressure that Trey Jones is applying is getting a little bit more intense. And Zion Williamson is a step quicker when he's sealing those passes. And I think that that's just a byproduct of the fact that they have a bunch of freshmen, right? Like, you see it a lot with teams like VCU back in the day, or West Virginia when Press Virginia was thriving, where you get a shot to go in, all of a sudden that press is on. They're pressing you that much more and that much more and that much more. Then they get another turnover and a basket goes in, and all of a sudden it's a little 6-0 run and they're still coming at you and you got to use a timeout. And then you come back in from the timeout and they get a trap in the corner. It just kind of builds and builds and builds. And I see that being what Duke is this year. So I think that Trey Jones is kind of part of that, if that makes sense, you know. And offensively, you are 100% right. He is a liability. And I know for a fact that that coaches, when they game plan, they want Trey Jones shooting that corner three. He's enough of a defender where they will let somebody else bring the ball up the floor, and they don't necessarily have to deal with his ball pressure. And then you don't guard him in the corner, and you basically take away all of what his effectiveness is. So I was one of the people that said that Trey Jones was the most irreplaceable. I didn't say most important. I said most irreplaceable player on Duke. And that was the moment I realized that I didn't have good enough friends, because people like you did not tell me that was stupid when I spent a week saying it after he hurt his shoulder. And I realized my mistake. I've come back from it. You know, we all have bad days, Jordan. I had a 1-for-9 day on that day with 4 turnovers. So I'm back. I've seen the light. I didn't, and you know what? I didn't even need you to get me there. So I'm proud of myself. You know, I'm growing as a man, as a human being, and you know, it's a good day.
Well, in my defense, I don't know about your other friends, but like, you know, we've established how much it takes me to have a stance on something. So at the time, I probably wasn't sure yet.
Yeah, but you are right. If he, I don't know if this is possible, but if he does find a way to be, let's say, a 35% three-point shooter, somebody where if he's standing all alone by himself in the corner, he makes 2 out of 5, 2 out of 6, something like that, then I think that that makes it so that you don't necessarily just leave him in the corner and fade guarding him in total. And if that happens, and all of a sudden there's so much more space for Zion and RJ Barrett, and you know, all of a sudden you're trying to guard Zion one-on-one, he's dunking on people, and RJ Barrett splitting help, and whatever it ends up being, and Duke becomes that monster again. So I don't know if that's possible. I don't know if it's something that he could do.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is, even if he does get it to 35%, I mean, you just have to pick your poison a little bit, and you still probably help off of him, but he just makes you pay. And so yeah, that it's still really, really hard to guard Duke. I mean, Virginia.
Are you saying it's hard to guard Zion Williamson? Wow, I thought you weren't a hot take guy.
So in that Virginia matchup, the first game, Virginia ran their regular pack line scheme, which should be built to try to stop a Zion Williamson drive or an RJ Barrett drive, and they just killed them. They just got to the rim. You probably saw more Virginia bad defense containing dribble drives in that game than you would see in about 10 games of normally watching Virginia. And then in the second game, they overcompensated a little bit. Part of it was Duke got really hot and hit threes. RJ Barrett in particular had, I mean, you probably live with some of the shots that he made. But yeah, so that is how good this team is, that they have those guys that you can game plan against. Trey Jones, Bolden, if he's in the game, Delorier, if he's in the game, Jack White's been kind of inconsistent from three. And that's how good they are. And you mentioned it on the defensive side of the floor. It depends what your offensive system is. If you're point guard heavy and you really need the point guard to initiate offense and get you in your stuff, then I think that Trey Jones has more of an influence than if you can have someone else bring it up and you're really equal opportunity and you can just put Bolden in a ball screen, which he's been pretty good at, better than I would expected. But you can mitigate Trey Jones's impact that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big thing with Duke in terms of what they've been of late, and why I think that they're actually starting to get a little bit better on that end of the floor. You know, Jack White has been, I don't know what happened to him, man. He was really good for a while and really effective. Yep. Playing a role. And when Duke was at their best for like probably the first 2 months of the season, it's when they had Jack White on the floor at the same time as the four freshmen. And that's not the case anymore. I think he's hit one of his last 25 from three, and he's not playing that many minutes. And he just, if he's not out there to space the floor, then you're much better off having Bolden. Because if you're not going to have someone space the floor, you might as well have the 7-footer that's gotten better at guarding ball screens.
Right. And a big thing that I was touting in the beginning of the year was put Bolden in ball screens, make him guard in space, put Bolden in ball screens. And I feel somewhat vindicated that I was right about that, because that's what teams do. I mean, Syracuse did it for the whole game. That's pretty much all they did. Louisville pretty much did that too during that stretch. And even going back much further than that, I mean, we've seen coaches that where they have been doing that. But to be honest with you, the results have just not been very good. It's hard to quantify or to figure out exactly why, but it's just Duke has so much length with Barrett, with Reddish, with Williamson, and with Bolden himself, that when you go one-on-one against him, it doesn't look pretty. His feet don't move that great, but the results have been bad, I think.
Yeah, like the only team that really has taken advantage of when Duke does their 1-5 switching thing was Duke in the game was Virginia in the game at Duke, and Virginia ended up losing that game. And I think it's because Bolden he's gotten to the point where he's able to move his feet enough where he's going to be able to contest you at the rim, right? You're going to be able to beat him off the dribble, but he has the length to contest you at the rim, and he also has the length to be able to play a step off while still getting a hand up on the three that you take. So I think it's small improvements in what he does defensively in isolation. And like, I just think he understands what it takes to guard ball screens more at this point. Like, I don't even think it's necessarily anything that he's doing athletically. It's just, he's not totally lost on that end of the floor. Mm-hmm. Like you go back and you watch the Gonzaga game, and in the first half, there's probably like, you could pull out like three or four instances in ball screens where you can just kind of take a screenshot and say, why the hell is Marquise Bolden in this spot right here? It makes no sense.
Yep. Yeah. So from an IQ perspective, I would agree with that. It'll be interesting to see how teams continue to attack Duke. So the other thing that if you watch the first play of the game, when teams are playing against Duke, and that's a pretty good way to see where a coach's head is at from a game plan perspective, what they're doing really early on. I remember St. John's ran the same backdoor play three times in a row against Duke. So they're going to pressure, they're going to deny. You want to try to backdoor them. So that's something that teams do. And the ball screening is another thing. And to me, from what I've watched, instead of going at Bolden in ball screens, if he switches and you get the ISO, Louisville had a lot of success with pick and pops, and you have to have the personnel to do it. But I think that you should be trying to shoot a lot of threes against Duke. And then once they have to come out on those threes, that's when you can do your work on the inside. But Louisville had about 10 threes out of ball screens in that good stretch that they had against Duke before they switched to the press and the zone.
Yeah, Steve Enoch, I remember specifically, had two that were absolutely wide open without anyone anywhere near him. And I think that is something that that Duke is willing to give up, especially if it's like a five-man shooting a three, because there aren't that many fives out there that are going to be shooting what? Like, I think Enoch is like 43% from three or something like that on a small number of threes. But anyways, Jordan, look, I've kept you here for an hour, man. I do appreciate you actually, taking a hard line and having a hot take on on something. So if you guys want, or if you're still listening, you need to go find his podcast. It is Solving Basketball. You can find it anywhere where you can get podcasts for free. You got to go find his YouTube channel, and you got to follow him on Twitter. It is at HoopVision68. Jordan, I appreciate the time, man. Thank you.
Yeah, no, a pleasure to do it, and thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.